Welcome to the Game History Podcast, featuring interviews with some of the most renowned authors and up-and-coming talent in LGBTQ mysteries, suspense, and thrillers. I'm your host, Brad Shreve, and Justine Adamick is here with her weekly recommendation. Before we begin with my interview with Anne Aptaker, we have Justine with her weekly recommendation. Hi, Justine.
Hi, how are you, Brad?
Life is good. I'm waiting for
4th of July.
4th of July, and hopefully a long weekend with my hubby.
That sounds wonderful. I'm looking forward to it too.
I hope he thinks Well, I hope he thinks it's wonderful. We'll see.
Well, who cares what he thinks? You'll enjoy it. So let me tell you about this book I have today. This was really quite the find. It's Fire Watching by Russ Thomas. It's his debut novel, published by a big publishing house.
Hold it. I didn't think big publishing houses did gay novels.
I didn't either. And having not really watched the industry for a while, I was surprised. I was very surprised.
Well, this is good news.
This is good news, and this is the quality one would expect from a big publishing house. It took him 15 years to write this debut novel, and you can certainly tell the effort and craftsmanship and the learning about writing that he has done in those 15 years. It has just been a marvelous read. I'd give it a glowing recommendation, but it probably deserves an intriguing recommendation. It's a marvelous mystery. The title, Fire Watching, is got a twofold meaning. There's an elderly lesbian couple who were characters who were fire watchers during Second World War. They're in London. The whole book is set in England. But they were in London, and in London during the Blitz, people would sit on top of the roofs and watch for fires from the bombings, and then they go downstairs when they saw a fire, when they spotted one, and they get help sent there. So that is one meaning. But then the other meaning is the killer. The killer is a fire watcher who does blog posts, and the police don't find these blog posts for quite some time, pretty deep into the mystery. But the reader is treated to them. The first scene out is a blog post in which the killer describes a fire, and each of these blog posts describes a famous fire in very lyrical, great detail. And the fire watcher, you can tell, is getting much enjoyment from talking about the fire. So they cover the Great Fire in London and the Second Great Fire in London. And then they talk about the fire at the library in Alexandria, which I don't think I ever realized was a fire. I always thought it was a flood because it's now underwater. And then the Great Chicago Fire and a few others. But they have this scattered throughout the book. And then as it gets further along, the blogs start to describe the fires that are going on and killing people. The detective, who's the main character, is gay. And that doesn't define him. He's not really struggling with his sexuality as so many novels do. But the other officers on the force, some of them see him as just the gay guy. And he tends to work alone in the cold case. And he doesn't make any friends because when he reviews cold cases, he often turns up mistakes people have made, and then occasionally mistakes they shouldn't have made, and sends them up to the police review board. So he has not made a lot of friends on the force. He works alone for a large part of this book. The original crime scene involves a burnt out old vicarage. The son of the murder victim comes back from university. He inherited the house, and he came into full ownership when he was 21. He's come back from university. He has construction workers working on the place, and they open up a wall in the basement, which doesn't seem to be a supporting wall, and they find the body of his father behind the wall. And since it's been there for 6 years, Adam Tyler, who's the detective sergeant, is assigned to go out and investigate this murder. From there, the number of suspects, it takes on the appearance of a cozy mystery. So you've got a small town, and everybody seems to be involved one way or another and turns up as a suspect one way or another. The course of figuring it out takes a lot of twists and turns. I was surprised at the end. I'll have to tell you that when I read mysteries, I try not to figure them out. I try to really just enjoy them and see all the clues and all the suspects as they come up. But most of them, you know, it becomes obvious pretty much, you know, by the time you're 75-80% in, it's like, okay, yeah, everybody can see where it's going and the crime solver is catching up. This one came with quite the surprise. So I'm hoping that other readers will be surprised as much as I was.
And you gave it a glowing recommendation.
I was going to give it a glowing recommendation, but it gets an intriguing recommendation.
Okay, I'm sorry. I had it the other way around. So tell our listeners what an intriguing recommendation means.
Well, intriguing recommendation is one of your favorites, Brad. It's a mystery that is complete with puzzles and has a lot of intricate details and a lot of clues and a lot of suspects. And it twists and turns along the way. It really is a marvelous story.
Sounds like it.
And you know, I'd say I read it in all one sitting, but as you know, I read most things all in one sitting. But this one, I really just shut out the world and got lost for several hours.
Oh, that is very you.
Well, not all of them hold my attention. I will read them in one sitting and look up and watch TV or talk to people. But this one really just gripped me and took me out of everything else for several hours. It was really I recommend this book as one everybody should pick up next.
And sounds good with an intriguing.
Enjoy the holiday, Brad.
You too, Justine. Thank you. We're sponsored by Requeered Tales, preserving our LGBTQ literary heritage one book at a time. Check them out at requeeredtales.com. Ann Aptaker's Cantor Gold crime mystery novels have won Lambda Literary and Goldie Awards. Her short stories have appeared in two editions of crime anthology Fidaro, Switchblade Magazine's stiletto-heeled issue, and will be featured in the Mickey Finn crime anthology released in the fall of 2020 from Down and Out Books. In addition to her literary work, Anne has had a long career as a curator and exhibition designer for galleries and museums across the country. She now writes full-time. Welcome to Gay Mystery Podcast, Anne.
Thank you. It's my delight and my pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me to your podcast, Brad.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to have you on. I hope I can get through the interview not as tongue-tied as when I did your intro.
I hope I don't have that effect on people. I'm not scary. I write crime, but I'm not scary.
Okay, good. I think I was reading it too fast.
I'm just a nice middle-aged dyke from New York. That's it.
Well, good. I won't let you scare me. Well, in addition to welcoming you to the podcast, I want to welcome you back to the States.
Thank you. Thank you indeed.
You spent a little time in Paris, a longer trip than you planned.
Well, actually, the time that I was there was what I'd planned. You know, it's for 3 months. What was unexpected, of course, was the coronavirus lockdown. That made it for a rather different vacation than I had in mind. But the lockdown started 2 weeks after I arrived in Paris and ended 2 weeks before, or it was lifted 2 weeks before I came back. So I had 2 weeks on either side of the lockdown. But essentially, in the middle of that, I had 2 months of confinement, which made my experience of Paris much more intimate than it would have been just as a tourist. So it was all in all the kind of experience that, you know, the average American tourist wouldn't have. And while it was, heartbreaking in a way because of the virus, in a way I wouldn't have traded it for the world. I got to know Paris at an extremely intimate level. And I hope to go back next year.
Well, it also sounds like a writer's dream in a sense.
It was. I knew that I would be spending part of my time, part of my day, each day writing. And then I thought what I would be doing was be spending the afternoon and evenings. I had friends in Paris, spending it with them and socializing and, you know, touring the city and getting involved in the social aspects. That part never happened. So during that period of absolute confinement, going out just for groceries and, you know, essentials and that sort of thing, I got quite a bit of writing done, which turned out to be a blessing because I now have this August deadline for my next book. And I got roughly half the book written when I was in Paris. So there's a silver lining to everything, I guess.
Well, and I got to tell you, I watched or I followed your Facebook post of your pictures of Paris. And I kept thinking of Giovanni's Room by James Baldwin.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there I was. I was literally, you could say, living that dream in that I was absolutely in a garret in Paris. If you saw the pictures, you saw the courtyard that, you know, my little garret overlooked. And I was absolutely in a Paris garret writing. What writer has not dreamed of doing that? And there I was doing that. And I loved every second of it. And of course, as you saw through the photographs, I established quite an intimate relationship with my courtyard and my rooftops.
Well, getting to your writing, you're mm-hmm. most known for your Cantor Gold series. Mm-hmm. Tell us about Cantor. Who is Cantor?
In her most rudimentary sense, she is an art thief and smuggler in the 1950s in New York. That would be who she is and what she does. On a deeper level, because I've set the series in the 1950s, it's of course a time when being a member of the LGBT community was against the law. You could be arrested for simply holding hands with someone of the same gender or wearing or cross-dressing. Or of course, if you were caught in a romantic clutch or dancing with someone of the same sex at a gay club or caught in your home in a romantic embrace, you could be thrown into jail or worse, you could be thrown into the psycho ward. It was considered, you know, perversion, a disease, in addition to being illegal. So Cantor has decided that in a way she's an army of one at that time. This was, of course, before the birth of the LGBT rights movement, or the very early stirrings of it as the series goes on. But in any event, she's decided that because the law labels her, identifies her as a criminal, essentially just for being alive, just for being who she is, that she doesn't owe the law any allegiance at all. So instead of working in the legitimate art field, being a curator or collector or, you know, something along those lines, she's decided to be an art thief and smuggler. And she has the last laugh in her criminal world because she makes a lot of money at it. And of course, money, whether you're a criminal or not, money is the ultimate protection. And so she protects herself because she makes fistfuls of cash in her criminal world. Also, emotionally and socially, but especially emotionally and psychologically, she thrives as a criminal. She likes that underworld because it allows her to be exactly who she is. The criminal underworld doesn't necessarily sniff at her for taking women to bed and so on. They all live outside the rules and they allow her to live outside the rules. So that is who she is. And as far as her name, a number of people have said, well, you know, told me, well, gosh, isn't Cantor an odd name for a female protagonist? You know, you don't explain the name at all. Did she choose it or whatever? And somewhere in the books, I do explain that her parents gave her that name. And I gave her that name because in Jewish tradition, a cantor is the ritual singer in the services, in the religious services. Now, Cantor's not a religious person, and neither am I, but I think of her as my ritual singer, as the ritual singer for gays and lesbians and trans people and the whole LGBT community. She is our ritual singer. She lives her life the way she wants to and doesn't take guff from anybody. So that's who she is. I hope that answers your question, long-winded as it was.
No, it wasn't. It was perfect. I don't think many people give us such a great character background. I enjoyed that.
Well, thank you.
In your research, what have you learned about the LGBTQ perspective during that era?
As a writer, that perspective is one of the things that fascinates me. I have a number of friends, of course, who write mainstream mystery books, and I've written mainstream stories and so on, and the perspective is very, very different. Let me give you the non-LGBT perspective for a minute. Even if you're writing from the criminal point of view, your relationship with the law is clearly defined. You know, the law works for you in a way, and if you're a criminal and you're acting outside of the law, you're working outside of something that was meant to work for you if you didn't break the law. Mm-hmm. If you're writing from the LGBTQ point of view, especially in the period that I've said it, but even to some extent today, even with the additional rights, but certainly in the period that I've said it, the law does not work for you. So Candor's relationship with the law, whether she would be a criminal or not, is entirely different than what it would be in a story about non-LGBT people, about the cisgendered world or the straight world. So as a writer, I have to be familiar with the social and legal milieu at the time, the threats to gay people at the time, the sort of under the radar life that gay people were forced to live at the time, all to evade the law. So writing from that point of view, it expresses a life that that lives under the threat of a law that does not work for that community. And so that community, whether they're criminals or not, you know, whether they're, you know, they could be school teachers or something, or, you know, accountants, they still have to live their lives to evade the law. And that's the point of view I write from.
What is one of the most interesting things you found in your research?
Oh, gosh. Oh, what a big question. I think, well, all right. Actually, now I can answer it now that I think about it. And it's a really marvelous thing that I found out. You know what we say today, we're queer, we're still here. And I think that is reflected in the period, the research that I've done about the 1950s and every period before that where gay people had to hide. So the most wonderful thing I found in my research was that we survived and that we created a culture, a very specific culture, a very colorful and creative culture. And it was such a creative culture that it wasn't only, so, you know, creative people, singers, dancers, whatnot, who created it, but all of us created it, created this extremely colorful and creative culture. Just being gay or lesbian or trans or queer of any sort was, in my view, and remains a creative act. So in my research of that period, the community's creativity in order to survive, and Candor's creativity, therefore, in order to survive, is what fascinated me most about that period, that culture that we created, a survivor's culture that was extremely colorful and extremely creative.
Oh, you certainly paint a vivid picture.
Well, I hope everybody buys the books and gets the full picture.
Buy the books. Your most recent is Flesh and Gold, which was published in 2018.
Right. That's the most recent one. And it's the only one that does not take place in New York. It takes place in pre-Castro Havana. Whoa, boy.
Oh.
Yes, indeed. There'll be lots of, you know, tropical nights and exotic stuff and all kinds of wonderful tropical things. And it was terrific to research. It takes place in Havana in 1952, you know, at the height, really, or almost the height of the glamour of pre-Castro Havana. And the reason that she goes there is that, as readers of the books know, the love of her life, Sophie de la Luna Isol, was kidnapped off the streets of New York and forced into the flesh trade or forced into prostitution. And it takes Cantor 2 years to find where she is, to locate her, or to realize that she's in Cuba. So she goes to Cuba, she goes to Havana to find her. And so the book takes place in there. And of course, there's, you know, she gets involved with the criminal underworld, including Meyer Lansky.
Ah.
It's the height of the mob time, of course, in Cuba. And she establishes quite a working relationship with Meyer Lansky. And I loved writing about him.
Considering Cuba at that time was the hot spot to go, were the LGBTQ laws as strict there as well as here in the States?
They were. And don't forget, Cuba at that time, before the communist takeover, and communism is, thinks of itself as a non-religious, you know, they sort of stamp out, culturally they tried to stamp out religious practice and so on in Russia and China and of course in Cuba. But in pre-Castro Havana, it was still heavily a Catholic country. And so that already put a stamp on the LGBT community. Cantor doesn't have to deal with that too much in Cuba because she's part of the underworld, and the underworld couldn't care less.
Yeah.
The underworld lived its life the way they, you know, any way they wanted to. But what she does get involved in, you know, that because she's looking for Sophie within the realms of prostitution, she really has to wander around in the depths of the flesh pots of Havana, some of which are quite glamorous and some of which are utterly horrifying. And of course, within the sexual flesh pots of Havana, being gay was no impediment. There was a trade for everybody, and Cantor runs into all of it. She has to work her way through all of it. And some of it's horrifying. the pre-Castro Havana was very glamorous, but the underside of it was very dark and very dangerous.
Yeah, it seemed very common during that time period, just like Vegas was that way.
Yeah. Havana even more so. Havana even worse, because in Vegas, you at least had some federal laws that you had to contend with. And it was a different culture as an American culture. Havana was really a free-for-all. And then once the American mob got in there and they didn't have American laws to contend with, and they essentially owned the government, the American mob owned the government, it was a free-for-all. And Cantor, of course, has to work her way through that and stay alive. She really has quite a time with it. It's of the four books, it's the darkest one so far.
It sounds dark and wonderful.
It's dark and juicy. It's very exotic. But I'm working on the next one now as well. So, see, you know, she has to rise from her experiences in Cuba. And she's back in New York. She is back in New York. There I was in Paris writing about her being back in New York.
Well, you're going to have to send her to Paris next time.
Well, she may. You know, the Paris experience may show up in, you know, some form or another. It really found its way into me as a person. So somewhere or another, it will come out in the work. It will come out in the writing for sure. Just when, I don't know, but it will. I know that it will.
Now, Tarnished in Gold, was that book number two?
Tarnished Gold was book number two. Exactly.
Okay, now that won the 2015 Lambda Literary Award for Lesbian Mystery. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to say, great job.
Thank you. I don't like
saying congratulations because you didn't win a prize. You worked hard for it.
Thank you for saying that. That's true. Anyone who wins an award worked hard for
it. Exactly.
For that matter, anybody who publishes a book worked hard for it, whether they win anything or not. So I appreciate you thinking about it that way. Yeah, any of us who won something, we weren't awarded it. We earned it, I suppose, or we like to think so. Yeah.
Well, I certainly think so.
Well, thank you.
Now, I got to tell you, you worked to what to me sounds like a dream job for a mystery writer. You worked as a report writer for a private investigation firm in San Rafael, California.
Right, yes.
I mean, that's just perfect. How much of your experience influenced your writing?
A lot. I got to see criminal activity up close and personal from a distance, in a way. I mean, I wasn't there in the midst of the crime. My job was to take the surveillance films and tapes that the detectives, the operatives, brought into the office with their notes and so on. And I would have to watch the surveillance. and then write the report for the client, which could be the courts or a private client or insurance firms or you know, whoever the client was, so lawyers or someone, or other, or law enforcement themselves if they were investigating, say, crooked cops or whatever. So I got to see a lot of crime taking place, and it wasn't pretty, but I learned two things. I lost all trust in the criminal justice system. It's gone. It's gone. You know, what's going on today, demanding police reform and so on. I was feeling this way, you know, those years ago when I was writing reports for the private investigations firm. I saw the broken criminal justice system and the horrors that it inflicted on people. I saw fixed trials. I saw bribed judges, obviously, and all kinds of things. And I saw terrible things that people do to each other in crime. So that was one thing that I saw. The other side of that was I saw the people who commit crime. Now, there are, of course, you know, crazy people out there, and there are evil people out there. But let's put those folks aside for a moment. You know, terrorists and, you know, serial killers and, you know, that sort of thing. Or greedy people who, you know, who steal viciously. Let's put those folks aside for a moment. That's a whole different category. Because what I also saw were people who essentially live under our feet. If the sidewalks or the floors were made of glass, you would see a whole different society living under there. And they are often committing crime to live or to fulfill a social function of their world because they have not been trained or socialized or accepted to break that glass and come up into our world. The two worlds don't deal with each other. We walk on them, they know it, and they're going to steal from us every chance they get. So when I was looking at crime, I was seeing oftentimes what we would think of as a crime might be, in that world, a business opportunity. One that, if they didn't take it, would be dishonorable. Maybe they couldn't feed their family. You know, it would be considered a failure not to take that opportunity to earn some coin. And, you know, I'm talking about things like workers' comp insurance fraud, where, you know, somebody takes a slip and in reality, at most, they sprain their ankle, if that, but they're going to put in a workers' comp claim saying, I hurt my back, I can't work. And in the meantime, they're lifting up front ends of cars and so on. You know, I mean, it's clearly fraud. But if the people that did that didn't always do that, in their world, they might be considered neglectful. You know, here was this opportunity to get cash in the barrelhead, cash in the lap, and you didn't take it. So you're talking about two different societies, one looking up at us and not liking what they see, and us looking down at them and not liking what they see, not liking what we see. My perspective then about crime and exactly what is the definition of crime was unalterably changed by working for a private investigations firm. Now everybody's going to hate me for what I said about crime.
No, it's a fascinating perspective, and thank you.
I mean, there are people out there who are, you know, who are awful. I mean, like, yes, there are. But, you know, in addition to those folks, I also saw what I described, you know, people for whom crime is a living, is an income. Because they may not have any other way, or don't know of any other way, or aren't allowed to have any other way, or are mocked for trying to do it another way. Or even if they do climb out of it into our, you know, upper world here, are often laughed at and so on. So, you know, crime down at that level is not always a product of evil. It's a product of need or desperation or socialization or life. And that's Cantor's, you know, that's where Cantor is coming from. If the world is going to treat her a criminal, she figures, well, what the hell, may as well be one, and she thrives.
Yeah, I can definitely see where your experience falls into that.
And she's very sexy. I don't want to paint her as this awful criminal. She's extremely sexy. She's well-tailored, and she loves the women, and they love her, and she's very, very sexy.
Well, she has the money to be well-tailored.
She has the money to be well-tailored. She also has the attitude to be well-tailored. In Tarnished Gold, for instance, one of the characters recognizes why Cantor dresses as well as she does. in that, you know, not only is money her protection, her wonderful, you know, handcrafted clothing, hand-tailored clothing, is her armor. It's her armor in the world to stand against a world that hates her.
Well, we're going to take a break here for awkward questions authors get.
Okay.
And if you're familiar with this, what I do is I spin the wheel and you get a question. And
oh boy, here it comes.
It's questions that we get that are sometimes awkward, strange, maybe rude. We don't know. So okay. Hold on while I spin the wheel.
Oh boy.
Okay. Yours is, okay, let's say, blunt.
Okay.
Are your books any good?
They're brilliant. Oh, for heaven's sakes. Yes, I think they are good. In all sincerity, I'm going to say they're good in that they are as good as I can make them, and I work very hard to make them good. Language matters to me. The rhythm of language matters to me. So when you read the Candor Gold books, you fall into this rhythm of language, which you're not always aware of, but it does carry you along. So are my books good? Hell yeah.
You know, I can hear that in your voice. Plus, knowing that you won a Lammy Award as well as a Goldie Award shows mm-hmm. that you're being recognized for it as well.
Well, thank you. It's very satisfying to, you know, to have your work honored. It really is. There's no doubt about it.
You kind of got into the law and quite a bit into the law and criminal activity, but how do you view the relationship between the LGBTQ community to law and society?
Oh, it's very fraught. We may be getting more rights lately, but you know, we know now that can turn on a dime. The current political atmosphere in America, with the leadership that we have in the federal government, and I don't know how, you know, how your listeners feel about all this, but in my point of view, I think that Mr. Trump and his cronies would take away the rights that we won if given the chance. He would take them away in a heartbeat. So I still think that our relationship to the law is not good, is not trustworthy. Hopefully sometime in the future, it will be, you know, permanently trustworthy. But for the moment, it is still untrustworthy.
Yeah. And I think it's safe to say that most of the listeners of the show are probably liberal minded in some sense, maybe not all, but probably most. And you know, what's funny is I don't think Trump really gives a damn about the LGBTQ community. I think he's racist, but I don't think he gives a damn.
Yeah.
But it plays to his followers, and that's what's important.
Exactly.
And
that's what it's,
yeah, if,
which makes it worse in a way, because if he really was against gay people, against the LGBT community, you would sort of know where he stands and you know what you're fighting against and so on. But because he's just playing to his base, his moves against us are like a backhanded slap. You never know where they're going. Whereas his racism is so obvious, you know where it's going. But with us, it's like this whiplash thing. You don't know where he's going to condemn us or confine us. And so while the racism is awful, his not giving a damn, his simply playing to his base, is in a way more difficult to fight. His racism is now being fought quite clearly. But how do you fight someone who you have no idea how they really feel about you? They're just willing to throw you to the lions on behalf of his supporters. Well, how do you fight that?
I wish I had the answer to that.
We all do, yeah. Just stay strong and live life. Yes, that's all you can
do. Now, how is writing crime fiction from an LGBTQ perspective different than more, air quotes, mainstream crime novels?
Well, since I've written both, I mean, you know, my Candor Gold novels, of course, are strictly, she's a butch dyke. I have a novella coming out, also in the fall, in October, as a matter of fact, called A Taco, A T-Bird, A Beretta, and One Furious Night. And the lead character in that is also a lesbian. She is an assassin. And she has mother issues. She has really serious issues. But it's being published by a mainstream publisher for a mainstream audience. So in a way, there's no difference. If you're going to write about crime, you're going to write about crime. But I've also written short stories for mainstream where they're, you know, where sometimes the character is gay, sometimes they're not. But it's always about the relationship to the law, always. That's what crime and mystery fiction is. It's a play, it's a story, a narrative about somebody's or a group of somebody's relationships to the law. So when I write mainstream stuff, the character's relationships to the law is very different. And we talked about this earlier. When I write, you know, from my life as a gay person, as a lesbian, then I have to put on my other law hat. You know, my relationship with the law personally is different. And so that can be more ejected into the books.
You mentioned novellas and short stories. Mm-hmm. And you've written a good number of them, as well as flash fiction. Mm-hmm. And you also received numerous accolades for that work. Mm-hmm. Well, okay. What attracts you to shorter fiction? Because I'm terrible at it.
yeah, I really do. I do like it. I find it very satisfying to write. I like getting to the beginning, the middle, and the end that quickly. I'm fumbling for this answer. I really don't know why I like it, except that I find it very satisfying to do. They're like set pieces, you know, they're like scenes, like set pieces, like little moments of theater. And since I have a theater background, maybe that's why I like short fiction so much. It's you get to the point much more quickly. Writing a novel, a full novel, is like this extended opera, you know, where you have to hit these emotional highs and lows in order to maintain the story. They have to have highs and lows and things in between. In a short story, you've got to get to those highs real fast and not worry so much about the lows. You just have to get to this little kernel of truth and sail, you know, ride that for a while, sail on that, and then you're done. And I guess that's what I like about it.
Well, I've been working at it. I want to do some novellas to give to some of my readers, but I really struggle. I just struggle with it. So I'm going to keep working on it. That's the only way I can do it.
You know, it's interesting for me to hear you say that. This novella that's coming out is the first novella, the only novella so far that I've done. And I've written novels and I've written short stories, and I'm perfectly comfortable writing both. The novella was the tough one to write because it was in between. And it didn't have that sense of opera, you know, of the highs and the lows and the whatnot, then the whole exposition that a novel allows you to swim around in. And it doesn't get to the point as quickly as a short story, or particularly flash fiction. It was somewhere in the middle, and I struggled with that until I finally got a handle on it. It was tough. That was the toughest thing for me to write.
Well, can we expect any standalone novels or a different series in your future?
Yes, actually, a couple of things. My agent right now is pitching, fingers crossed, pitching a book that takes a historical crime fiction novel, takes place in New York in 1899, about a woman who is recently widowed and thrilled about it. And it frees up her life. And through investigating a crime, she really comes face to face with herself. So this is one. And then on the lesbian side of the house, my home, my love, you know, me, on the lesbian side of the house, I do have another historical possible series in mind after I finish this next Kendra Gold book. I want to speak to my current publisher, my new publisher, about this other series, which would also be a historical, about a pair of lesbian detectives, amateur sleuths, in New York in the 1890s. So, yeah, there's lots of stuff in the works, absolutely. But first, I have to finish the next Kendra Gold book. Deadlines, deadlines.
Yep, don't overload yourself too much.
Well, you know, we're all just locked at home. I mean, in a way, what else do I have to do? The time is really kind of delicious.
That is true. That is true. Well, Anne, I cannot believe a half an hour has whizzed by this like it has.
Oh, my. Oh, me neither. Oh, my.
It's been a pleasure to have you on.
And it's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you again for this opportunity to tell the world about my work and about Kindergold.
Oh, you had me enthralled.
Oh, wonderful. That's my job.
You did well. Okay. Thank you again.
Thanks, Brad. Have a good evening. Bye-bye.
Hit the subscribe button wherever you hear our show so you don't miss a single episode. Tell a friend too. Thank you for listening.